number 06513, from Ali against the United States. Ms. Neal.
Yes, thank you. Your action. To reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. May it please the court, my name is Scott Young, and I'm here on behalf of the plaintiffs in this case. And actually, one of the plaintiffs is sitting with me. His name is Ron Gandy. Basically, I represent 10 air traffic controllers. Mr. Gandy's from Forsyth, New York. They're from basically all over the country. And what this issue basically boils down to is, obviously, we are appealing from the trial court's decision to dismiss our complaint for lack of jurisdiction. We disagree with that. We think we did cite to a money mandating statute, that is 5 U.S.C. 5334B. We think pursuant to the Fisher case, that frankly should have ended the inquiry, and the court should have allowed the case to proceed in its normal fashion. But I think with respect to understanding where the court below made the mistakes that it did, it's important to have a general understanding, although it's been briefed, as to the factual underpinning behind this case. Basically, my clients are 10 air traffic controllers, probably a group of
They were level one people that got caught.
With
the injunction out in Ohio, and then when the injunction was lifted, and when they finally decided to promote them into either level two or higher towers, that basically the new pay system had come into effect, the ATC pay system, and you argued that your client should have been promoted within GS as step one, and then that would then entitle them to 5334B and Rule 35. So, and you're arguing that you were legally entitled, right, to have your client's process under 5334B and Rule 35. Why? What is the legal reason why you're entitled to that treatment?
Because they were still under GS pay system at that time.
Well, the at that time is the place where things get fuzzy for me.
Okay.
I think we're right at the critical legal question in this case, which is on the day that they went from level one to level two, your view of the matter seems to be that they went to level two as GS employees and therefore were entitled, whether in fact they were promoted or not, they were entitled to a promotion from a GS-10, which I think was the GS level at level one, to an 11 or higher, and therefore were entitled, once they had the 11, to carry the two-step bump up into the ATC system, correct?
That is exactly correct.
Okay. What's the legal basis for that when the government's position is what happened is that they went from the GS system into the AT system at the time that they moved to level two, and therefore they never went through this intermediate step of going up to GS-11, but instead they went from GS-10 to ATC, hence no 5334. What's the legal basis for your argument that unlike the people in Clark, these people had that intermediate step?
Because these individuals, unlike in Clark or Libretto or these other cases that talk about the GS, WS systems and the transfer from one pay system to another pay system, the essential distinction in this case is that these individuals were being converted from one pay system into another pay system.
Are you arguing those cases are inapplicable?
They are inapplicable, yeah. They are not applicable to that.
So for purposes of argument, you lose that argument. But assume for purposes of the discussion that Judge Rice and I are having with you that the old cases apply.
And
that you, the only way you get access to 5334 is if you're solely within the GS.
And I agree, and we are arguing that. I am definitely arguing that, and that I think is where, when I read the trial court's decision, and he, on the one hand, said at the outset, I'm dismissing the case because you didn't allege a violation of a money mandating statute.
Well, the place where you depart from Judge Baxter is where he said on page 9 in the final paragraph, the GS pay system no longer existed at the time of the transfer.
Right.
Well, it existed for purposes of paying them because the last paycheck they got was under the GS system. Right.
And here's the other thing, and this would be, as it applied, and this is where I think he made another mistake in his findings of fact. And again, we're on a motion to dismiss, and so
we're still trying to get the legal reason. Why was it illegal
Because we still were within the GS pay system. That is the entire crux of our case. We are arguing that at the time, and the personnel records, I know we're not on a motion for summary judgment, we're on a motion to dismiss, but the personnel records would indicate that these individuals throughout 1999, throughout 1990, or throughout 1998 and throughout 1999 continued to be paid under the GS pay.
When you say throughout 99, you mean after they went to the level 2 facilities? Or
when they landed, our position with respect to, and I understand your question, I think it's the heart of this entire case. And frankly, aside from the motion to dismiss, it's the heart of whether or not these individuals win or lose ultimately down the road. The reality in terms of what happened, and I think it was lost upon the trial court judge, is these individuals did not go up to the ATC pay system and automatically convert that to the bottom of the pay band, as suggested in the findings of fact. That's not true. They still looked at where they stood at their GS level for purposes of determining where they fit into the ATC. For example, my client here, Mr. Gandhi, who happens to be one of them, that transfer. He was a GS 10, step 10 at the time of the transfer. When he went up to a level 2 facility under the old rules, that would have meant that he would have been a GS 10, or a GS 11, step 7.
Step
7, and that's where it's important. What happened to Mr. Gandhi when he went to the higher level facility is he transferred in to the ATC pay band as a GS 11 step 7. He didn't go down as a step 1. In other words, if he was a GS 10 step 10 or a GS 10 step 5, he's basically at the middle of the pay band. What should have happened when they landed at the next higher level, they went to a higher level facility. 5334B, we argue, triggers the right to a guaranteed two-step increase. Now, because they are not transferring from one pay system to another one, but really what's happening is they're converting from one to another. He was entitled to go into the higher level facility, not as a GS 11 step 7, but to get the two-step increase and be a GS 11 step 9. And so it's not everybody was a GS 10 step 10, and so you're going to have some variations of that. And frankly, if somebody went from a level 1 to a level 4 facility, which would have been way above the 6.72 step, it's not going to matter. Which is why these individuals, the 10 here, and there might be 30 in total, but the 10 that are behind this particular case, went to the level 2 facilities, went to the next higher level facilities, they all got pay raises, and that's where the problem is. The grievance procedure doesn't apply because they didn't get a complete pay cut, they got a pay raise.
Government says, isn't it, that this is a matter of grievance based on...
You see, but the grievance only kicks...
That step has not been taken.
No. These individuals have attempted to exhaust everything. MSPB, the grievance procedure, basically the word from them is, well, we don't handle pay conversion, you technically got a pay raise, you didn't get a pay cut, so you're out of luck. And so everybody said, you're out of luck, the venue, the door is someplace else.
But the grievance procedure, which the government says, is in fact what would be most directly involved here. You say that has been pursued unsuccessfully?
Not by me, but my understanding, not by me as a representative of them. My understanding is, and if one looks at the collective bargaining agreement per se, it's not going to govern this situation. I would also point to...
So the answer is yes or no, or you don't know?
I believe it has in some circumstances. I'm sorry, that's the best answer I can give.
Well, if the collective bargaining agreement didn't anticipate this problem and didn't provide... I mean, all the pay, as I understand it, for the air traffic controllers now, except if there are any left in level one, is governed by the collective bargaining ATC system, correct?
That's correct.
All right. So if the collective bargaining agreement didn't put in something to protect these people from what happened to them, then assuming that you're wrong, that there is a legal remedy here under the statute, they're just out of luck, right?
If you can't get relief from you, you're out of luck.
So it seems to me the problem is really that the collective bargaining agreement didn't recognize that there could be a delay and that people would be treated differently depending on when they moved. If they moved before the October of 98, I guess it was, when the ATC went in, then they'd get the bump up because they'd still be in the GS system. If they moved afterwards, then you have the legal problem we have here, which is that they never actually have an SF50, I assume, that says you are now a GS11. I assume that there is no, I mean, you tell me if I'm wrong about this, but I'm assuming there is no SF50 that says you are a GS11, correct?
There is.
They were never actually promoted to GS11 or anything else other than the 10s. They went directly from GS10 into the ATC system, right?
Well, they were transferred. There was some personnel paperwork that said you were being transferred under the GS rules.
Right.
And you were being transferred to the higher level facility.
You know what I'm talking about the SF50s, right? I mean, you get
yes.
In the government, the one thing that always happens is you get a piece of paper when you get a promotion, and it says, as of July 1st, 2008, 2007, you are a GS11. And that's how you know. That's the day you became an 11. Now, I take it that that didn't happen in this case. No one has a piece of paper that says, I am now a GS11.
Well, we didn't get past the motion to dismiss stage, so
well,
we weren't allowed.
Well, they have the paper. I mean, it's not something you have to discover. They give this to the
They transferred in, and then they were converted. That part is correct. But I think...
Didn't you just tell us that at the time of the transfer, they did get a grade increase?
Well, they got an increase in pay, but the thing to remember with respect to all of this is the ATC pay band, or pay, was created out of a $200 million surplus. And so what gets my clients upset is not that they're sitting here thinking necessarily that they're underpaid as air traffic controllers. It is knowing that if they had transferred 1 year earlier than what they did, and so perhaps sitting next to somebody else who's at a level one that transferred in 1997 instead of 1999, that they're making $13,000 more than they are, that were both GS10 and Step 10s.
That's the sort of situation that, at least according to the government, is something that should be worked out through the grievance system.
The grievance procedure, we don't believe, would be able to cover this. But we also
other than your right to a 5% pay increase in the first year, then level one people don't have any presence in the memorandum of understanding. Right.
Actually, the level one, there is a one provision in Rule 35, which is a conversion rule, that speaks to the fact that they're going to continue to be paid under the GS pay regulations, or the old pay regulations, which is GS, until they transfer and are converted. And so that is the underpinning that the GS continue to apply to them. That's the footnote to Rule 35, and we think that just
because... Yeah, but again, I come back to it. What's the... Assuming for purposes of argument that the government could have done what you want them to do, which was to promote you within GS,
okay,
and cut an SF50 that says you're now an 11,
okay,
right, and then say, okay, you're an 11, now we're going to convert you to ATC. I mean, assuming that could have happened, why are you entitled to that as a matter of law?
Because 5334B entitles us to a two-step increase. If you're in the GS pay system, that particular statute entitles you to a two-step increase.
If you're being moved in the GS pay system,
right.
Assume that those cases have held that you don't get to 5334B unless you were moving laterally up or down in the GS system.
Right, and we're contending.
Judge Bass here and the government say you weren't moving in the GS system, you were being exited from the GS system. Goodbye. You're going to the new ATC system.
It's our contention that we, and that's where I disagree with Judge Baxter.
Right, was it illegal for the government to say, we're going to treat the GS system as being alive with regard to your clients for purposes of your paychecks, because the last minute of the last hour your client worked in the level of tower, he got paid under GS, but we're going to say the GS system is no longer applicable. Okay, once you have the collective bargaining agreement hits, you're going to say the GS system is no longer applicable for purposes of promotions.
But they continue to be paid in the GS system until they hit the door of the new facility.
Let me ask you this question, which might be important. In the GS system, you're in a GS, say you're a 10, and you GS 10, 10. You could go up to an 11, right? Step increase?
Right.
Were any of the people who were at the level one towers moved up in step? as opposed to being moved over to 11? I mean, they, between the time that the collective bargaining agreement took effect, right, and the time they were actually converted, did they actually enjoy step increases in the GS system? They were there long enough. Step increases come like every year, don't they, every couple of years?
They were there. They were there for an extra year. I don't know. I honestly don't.
Well, I mean, if some of your clients received step increases during that time period, that would certainly suggest that the FAA was using the GS system for more than simply cutting paychecks.
Yes, Your Honor, that's exactly right. And I can say that I've seen their personnel records and the personnel files in 1999 to the extent that they've had.
This case were sent back.
Yes.
On the grounds that there had been a mistake here in dismissing the case from one jurisdiction. What are you going to do by way of discovery to try to shore up your legal entitlement to 5334B and Rule 35? Is there anything else that you would pursue by way of discovery that would shore up or help make your argument you think that?
I think doing exactly as you suggest, do discovery, obtain the complete sets of the personnel files, find out exactly how they treated not just my clients. I mean, I represent 10 of them, but that decided that they were upset enough to pursue this, but there were a whole group of them that were delayed in the, you know, that were delayed in the fourth year of the privatization of the program, and I think we'd be entitled to see exactly as you inquired as to how they were treating them with respect to step increases, et cetera, during that period of time of delay.
Let's hear from the government.
May it please the court. The appellants here cannot establish a right to have 5334B applied to them because at the time that the privatization, when they were still working at the Level 1 facilities and they were being paid under the collective bargaining agreement, which referred to the GS system, and what it actually said was that they would be paid in accordance with current pay policies, except that their base pay would be increased by 5% in the first year. Arguably, at that point, they were no longer really governed just by 5334B or governed by 5334B at all. They were under the collective bargaining agreement and the memorandum of understanding.
We're specifically in that collective bargaining agreement to say they're not going to be paid under GS after the bargaining agreement comes into effect.
That's my argument, Your Honor. I believe it's at the appendix at page 41. The memorandum of understanding, what it says.
At 41, you're talking about the note? Those facilities will be treated according to the current pay policy, with the exception that their base pay will be increased by 5% the first year?
Correct.
And that means they were out of GS?
It means that their pay was governed by the collective bargaining agreement, not simply by 5334B. At that point,
what part of the pay? The 5% increase?
Yes, I mean that's in place of that to me. I mean that suggests that it's in place of whatever step increase.
What are current pay policies? Those three words. What does that refer to?
That's the GS system.
Correct.
GS.
Correct.
So basically, all that that note is saying is that we're not changing the GS system that currently applies to level people, the one people, except to the extent that they get this 5% increase, right? So whatever statutory provisions the GS system has that apply to it, apply to all the level one people under the agreement.
As long as they're at level one
facilities. Right,
sure. Given that fact, let me ask you this question. Why didn't FAA promote these plaintiffs from the 10 to the 11 within GS before they converted them to ATC?
Because they couldn't.
Why not?
Because after October 1998, the GS system no longer applied to the higher level, to level 2 and above air traffic controllers. It simply didn't apply to them.
Pursuant to because
of these aren't level 2, these are level 1. We're talking about promoting a level one. We're not talking about level two at all. Why didn't they?
Because as long as they're level one employees, they're not entitled to any promotion. That's not, they haven't moved from...
Did FAA move anybody who was in GS-10, say at level 9 or 10, did they give them a step increase after the collective bargaining agreement took effect? And before they were actually converted?
It depends when they were converted. I mean, if it were before...
Well, is it possible, is it, as a matter of fact, it is possible, is it not, that some of these individuals who were being paid in GS received a step increase within GS after the collective bargaining took place and before they were converted?
Only if it was before October 1998, when the new ATC pay system...
It could have gotten a step increase. I think what you're... correct me if I'm wrong, but I think what your position is, if I understand it, is they could have gotten a step increase but not a grade increase because the grade was locked at 10 for the level 1s, correct? You couldn't get an 11. You can get a grade 10, GS-10, for everything where from step 1 to step 10 for level 1, but you couldn't get a GS-11, correct?
I'm not sure that's clear from there. I'm not sure that's stated in...
Were there any people at level 1 that were 11s?
I don't know. I don't think...
Well, was there any law in effect that would have made it illegal for FAA to promote someone from a grade 10 to a grade 11 after the collective bargaining agreement took place, but before 1999 in November?
Well, after the collective bargaining agreement took effect and before October of 1998. In October of 1998...
No, I'm just... Can you answer my question? I'm just trying to talk about whether it would have been illegal for FAA to say, well, I've got these people working in the tower over there, and they're GS-10s, and I'm contemplating converting them, moving them to a level 2. I'm going to promote them now. If you go back and look at what happened to the 756 level 1 controllers who were, quote, converted over to level 2 and above before the lawsuit was filed,
yes,
all of them were promoted within GS, right?
Because the GS system was still in effect for all the air traffic controllers. That's how they were paid.
Well, I mean, does your whole case turn on the fact that the GS system, after the collective bargaining agreement took place, it was still in effect for level 1 controllers with regard to getting paid and for step increases, but it was no longer applicable for grade increases? Is that what you're telling me?
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
What's quite important, because I was asking you why you the FAA converted 756 people who were in the level 1 towers, and they bumped them up in GS from 10s to 11s, right? And then put them over, and they were working in level 2 towers as GS-11s, and then they got converted from 11 into ATC, right? Then the lawsuit came along, and then you got this small collection of people coming along afterwards.
Right.
And my question is, if FAA had wanted to, would they have been able to treat these plaintiffs the same way they treated the 756?
No.
Why not?
Because the GS system, Judge Breschere was correct about this, the GS system no longer was in effect.
All right, let's stop right there. Was it in effect for any purpose whatsoever?
Only insofar as the people, the individuals stayed, and only by virtue of the collective bargaining agreement, only insofar as they stayed at level 1 facilities.
That's the only people we're talking about, man.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So the GS system did stay in effect for them.
They were paid in accordance with current pay policies, which refers to the GS system. It's an altered, I mean, my position is that it was altered, the GS system was altered by the CBA with this 5% increase, which took the place of whatever step increases they might have.
So your argument is that the reason why you didn't treat these 10 plaintiffs the same way you treated 756 others is because you were legally precluded from doing so.
Because they transferred after October 1998, yes.
Well, let me ask the same question that Judge Clevenger was asking. Let me try to ask it a different way, because I have the same question and I'm not satisfied that I understand the answer. Suppose that the administrator of the FAA had decided, you know, it's really a bad idea to have people working side by side with significantly disparate pay, even though they have the same obligations. Just a morale problem. So we're going to try to find a way. It came to you as the FAA lawyer and said, find a way to make sure that even after, for people that transfer after this memorandum of understanding goes into effect, try to see if you can find a way for us to pay them equivalently to the people that transferred before. And you came up with a proposal. And your proposal is, here's how we can do it. As long as they're in level one, the day before they transfer to their proposed level two, what we can do is we can make them 11s. As soon as we do that, then when they move into the ATC, they'll move in the same way that their colleagues did, because somebody who's in the position of being a JS 10, 10 step 10, will become an 11 step 7, and then they'll go into a higher pay band. That's your idea. Now, you go to the FAA administrator and you say, here's my proposal. Does the FAA's general counsel say, we'd love to do that, but we can't, and here's why? That's, I think, Judge Clevenger's question. Is the answer to that that you could not do that as a matter of administrative maneuvering to try to achieve an equitable result?
Yes, I think that you could not, that the FAA could not have done
that. Okay, that was part A. Part B is, what legal prohibition prevents you from doing that?
Well, the step increase that they claim to be entitled to under 5344B applies to being promoted. I mean,
I understand. I am saying that you would propose to promote them to an 11 even while they're in level 1, so that they would get the step increase, they get the benefit of 5334, which they clearly would at that point, and then they go into a higher pay band when they went over to level 2. The question is, what legal prohibition is there that prevented the FAA from doing that? I think that's what both Judge Clevenger and I are trying to get at. You say they couldn't do it. And my question is, well, if you're confident they couldn't do it, you must know why. So why?
Because they hadn't been promoted at that point. That's the problem.
I'm suggesting that the FAA decides to promote them. The administrator signs a piece of paper and says, as long as this is okay with the general counsel, these people will be promoted, and then sends that memo down to the general counsel. What does the general counsel do? Say, no, sorry, administrator, we can't do this?
If the GS system, the GS pay system, would allow an agency to increase pay without there being a concurrent increase in responsibilities, then that would be okay. But I don't think that it does.
Let me ask you a question. Was there a highest grade that a level one controller could enjoy?
I don't believe that's stated in the record.
You don't know that as a matter of fact.
I don't.
Yeah, because if level 10 was the highest you could be as a matter of law in the position, then they couldn't promote you to an 11 while you were still at a level 1. Whereas they could promote you if they put you over to level 2, as happened with the earlier people, and then bumped them up then. Doesn't it suggest that there are some factual issues here that could perhaps be fleshed out a little better before we decide that there's no cause of action?
I don't think so, Your Honor.
You don't know the answer to the question?
No, I don't think it makes any difference, Your Honor. I don't think it matters.
You can't tell us for certain that it would have been against the law for FAA to provide the relief that the plaintiffs asked for. There's an allegation here that the reason why FAA didn't give them the same treatment was in retaliation for having participated in the Ohio lawsuit. We haven't had any discovery on that issue.
No.
Is your understanding, when these controllers finally transferred to level 2, that they were then paid the same as those who were already in level 2?
They were converted under Rule 35 of the Memorandum of Understanding in the Collective Bargaining Agreement. And I think that's the more important question here is, I'm not sure that is whether it was illegal or would have been illegal for the FAA to do anything differently, but whether these appellants have any right to them. They're union. It seems to me they're bound by what their union agreed to in the collective bargaining agreement.
Now, that didn't answer the question.
I'm sorry.
My question is, when they transferred finally to level two, were they then paid the same as those who were already in level two? Yes or no?
They were paid, they were converted under the same provision.
That's what you said.
Yes.
But that wasn't my question.
Why would they be here if they were being paid?
They were paid less.
I gather that they were paid the same, and but that they are seeking is some retroactive filling of the gap.
What the Rule 35 based the new pay under the ATC system on the then existing GS system. And so when they weren't promoted, when they didn't get the benefit of this two-step increase that they're requesting, they went into the new system based on a lower GS level.
So they are...
Well, let me just make sure that I understand.
Yes.
What you're saying. After the transfer, when they started working in the level two facilities, are you saying that they were then paid less than those who were already working in the level two facilities?
Probably they were paid less than some people and more than others. It would depend on how the other people, where the other people were at the time that they converted.
Well, if they took two people who were exactly similarly situated, somebody who was a GS-10-9, and then went in before the memorandum of understanding, went in back in the old days under the GSA promotion.
Yes, I mean, certainly.
Yes, and take an exactly comparable person who's going to come in now after October. Are those two people getting, is their base salary the same?
No, it's not. I mean,
the person that went in earlier is making more.
Correct.
And that's the reason why these people are here bearing the loss.
Yes, sir, that's right.
That was a simple answer to Judge Newman's question.
What do you
think?
I'm sorry, I thought that's what I was trying to explain. Well, I guess
I'm let me ask you about the dismissal for want of jurisdiction. I mean, we've in the Fisher case, we said, I think, correct me if this is not a fair summary of it, that if you have a money mandating statute, even if you have a losing claim, even if your legal theory for why you should win under the money mandating statute is wrong and you will end up with a judgment against you in the Court of Federal Claims, nonetheless, the Court of Federal Claims has jurisdiction to tell you that you lose. Why isn't that this case? They have, with respect to 5334, they have what Judge Baskier said was a money mandating statute. Now, you say that they have a losing case under 5334, and you may be right, but why isn't that a decision on the merits of failure to state a claim as opposed to a jurisdictional problem? Another way to ask the question is, are you saying, if you say that this is jurisdictional, that the only cases in which the Court of Federal Claims has jurisdiction are cases in which the plaintiff is entitled to judgment in its favor?
No, I'm not saying that.
Well, why is this a case? Why is this not a case under Fisher in which the court had jurisdiction to decide the merits of the 5334B issue?
Because they've cited because of my opposition that 5334B doesn't apply to them. It's not that they failed to state a claim under it. It's just it doesn't have any application.
But isn't that the merits? I mean, in other words, if I come in and I say I am entitled to be paid under the Magistrates Special Benefits Act, because in a loose sense I'm a magistrate, you know, even though I'm a court of appeals judge, but the magistrates get some special benefit under some statute, and I say I'm entitled to that. I go into the Court of Federal Claims with my statute in hand. Wouldn't the proper response of the Court of Federal Claims be to say, I'm sorry, Judge Bryson, you're not a magistrate, therefore you lose on the merits. Not, I'm sorry, I don't have jurisdiction to address your claim. Wouldn't that be right?
Yes, yeah.
Well, then why isn't that this case?
Because citing 5334B, they argue that it applies to them, obviously. But it's the same as if it identified some other. I mean, Fisher doesn't stand for the proposition that identifying any money mandate statute. I mean, there has to be some connection.
Let me ask you this question. Let's assume on discovery the plaintiffs were able to identify one or two or three level one controllers who, after October of 1998, were put into the level two towers in 1999 somehow, but nonetheless they were promoted within the GS system before they were converted over. Let's assume that discovery proved that their FAA actually did, for a small handful of people, exactly what these plaintiffs want, right? Then we'd have an instance of disparate treatment, wouldn't we?
Well, that's not alleged in the complaint, Your Honor.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. You better read the complaint. They allege that they're being treated differently than other people.
They're alleging that they're being treated.
You look at the complaint broadly. Let's assume that for purposes of our discussion right now, this claim of disparate treatment is sufficiently pled. If the facts showed disparate treatment, wouldn't there possibly be some further litigation and maybe a glimmer of hope for the plaintiffs?
If all those assumptions were correct, I suppose so. But I think the disparate treatment that they're complaining about is not people who were promoted after October.
Well, you have to read the complaint broadly, right? But my point is that there seems to me that there are some possible circumstances in which the government might face a little bit of exposure, given the fact that there could be further discovery. Let me ask you this question. It struck me that the case below was pitched entirely as a jurisdictional case.
We already
said dismissed for want of jurisdiction, correct?
Were
the plaintiffs fairly on notice that they were being put up for grabs on failure to state a claim?
Yes, sir. We argued both. We argued it as both 12b1 and 12b6.
Okay.
For failure to state a claim.
We need to close the argument. Thank you. Okay, Mr. Young, you have a few minutes.
Yeah, I think clearly, based upon some of the questioning, I think under the Fisher case, we clearly have identified a money mandating statute. I think there clearly are issues that...
Well, the question is whether you've made a non-frivolous allegation that you're entitled to the benefits of the money mandating statute. That's what I want to pursue a little bit. I mean, your equal protection argument, that may fall because the Court of Federal Claims doesn't have jurisdiction to award money on the Fifth Amendment. So you would have to try to argue that you're really not asking for money under the Fifth Amendment, you're asking for money under 5334B, access to which was denied to you because of disparate treatment, right?
Right.
So you feel as if your argument of unequal treatment passes the sniff test for having had a non-frivolous allegation?
I believe so. I believe that combined with all the other allegations that we made, and frankly, the complaint, and knowing from doing the research that I had, I knew and I advised my clients that frankly, the government in this particular case will probably try to get this case thrown out. And I said, as a result, I need to be as careful as I can to make sure that I plead your case as factually correct as I understand it from you. And so there are a lot of facts that are being alleged in a particular claim, in the complaint. Yes, there are allegations of violations of the collective bargaining agreement, but the key thing for purposes of conferring jurisdiction below is 5334B. And I think, while I understand that, and I'm not suggesting that Clark or the other cases are inapplicable or somehow decided wrongly and that we're asking you to sort of deviate or create some exception. Those cases dealt with the transfer from the WS to the GS or vice versa. There was no conversion going on. Here, there was a fixed amount of money of $200 million that was supposed to be distributed pro rata based upon where my clients were situated. And the ones that are parties to this suit, because they had a loss, They typically were air traffic controllers for 15, 20, 25 years. You had to be have that much experience to be high enough on the step level to have a loss in that regard. The other big difference between the WS and the GS and the Clark cases, and why I think not only is our case not frivolous, I think we are absolutely entitled to judgment. I believe that fervently, and that's because this is not a situation contrary to the factual finding of Judge Baxter. This is not a situation where they went from level one to level two, bottom of the pavement, brand new hives. That isn't what happened. What happened is, and what happened in Mr. Gandhi's case, for example, he was a GS 10, step 10. He went up as a GS 11, step 7, for purposes of conversion.
Well, whoa, that's the key question. When was he a GS 11, step 10, except in a sort of constructive sense, as you're arguing?
Okay.
Because if you can point to some point in time in which he was a GS 11, step 7, you win.
This is where I'm going with this. GS 10, step 10 is equivalent in pay to a GS 11, step 7. At that time, they're about the same pay. So you have a GS 10, step 10 being paid right around the same as a GS 11, step 7.
What you're saying is he went into the pay band.
Well, he went into the ATC pay band
at a level slightly above where he was when he was a GS 10, step 10. But you're not saying, if I understand you, that he actually was converted to an 11.
Well, no, he was put into the ATC pay system as if he was converting. Because again, it was a conversion. So if you had somebody that was going in, and that's why, Ms. Stanford, you asked the question, were my clients making less or more than everybody else at the level twos? It depended. Mr. Gandhi, at the time that he transferred in, went in as somebody with 15 years of experience, and he found out when he landed there, based upon the fact that he lost some pay steps during the conversion, or didn't get the benefit, I should say, of 5334B, that he was being paid the same amount as somebody with 5 or 6 years of experience. He lost that. So instead of being converted at, say, 90% of the pay band, he was converted at approximately 50% of the pay band based upon the fact that he didn't have 5334B applied. There was a conversion. In other words, this is not a situation as in Clark or Librato or the other cases where you stood in the other pay system had nothing to do with where you would stand in this one. There's no dispute. They were converted. They were converted based upon where they stood at the TS level. So the only issue is the triggering event we contend for 5334B is when you go to a higher level job or a higher level facility, you're entitled to a two-step increase in pay. Because they were being converted, they were entitled to get the two-step increase and then convert. They got converted at the higher level facilities as if they were still working at the level ones. That's what this whole case is about. If they were a GS 10 step one, meaning a new hire at the level one or step two, we wouldn't be here because the level two facility would be sufficiently higher that there'd be no loss. Or likewise, if they were a level one and had transferred to a level three or a level four or a level five facility, then the bottom of the pay band would be sufficiently higher that they wouldn't have had any loss.
The difficulty to see is that even if the FAA could have done what you wanted them to do, the question is whether they were legally obligated to do so.
I know we're running out of time, we respectfully submit that they were. We think that 5334B was entitled to this two-step process. The trial court actually, at page 9 of its decision, made the finding that if we had alleged that in our complaint, the two-step process, then we would be right. If factually we had alleged that the conversion was a transfer within the GS system and then a conversion.
You mean if you proved it?
Well, if we elect for a motion to dismiss, right, we also win the case. But he said that if we allege that in our complaint, if we allege that in our complaint, then we would have conferred jurisdiction upon the court.
Thank you, Mr. Young. We have that. That's in the briefs as well.
Okay, thank you.
This is taken under submission.
Thank you. All rise. The Honorable Court is adjourned from day to day.